Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hi, and welcome to the Pilgrims Podcast for the very nearly the last week of March. And we're very delighted that you're joining us this evening, or this morning, or whenever you happen to be listening to this. I am Alan. I am the
Patriarch.
And,
and I'm the progeny.
And we are looking forward to this week's discussion. We're going to be looking at a name which you have probably heard of before. Steven Spielberg. But, and I don't know if Steven Sondheim has made any movies or not.
I don't even know who he is. Who is he?
I think he's a playwright, or he's basically a musician. But I think he's probably a pianist. He might be a truck driver. I don't know. But
well, that actually sounds like quite a few characters in Steven Spielberg's movies. Drivers.
We'll have to look it up. But I think he's a musician. Maybe a lyricist for, you know, Broadway shows.
You know, in fact,
I
think he might be a diplomat.
I took
on
that class
on high level
in college. I took, you know,
truck driving.
lyricist for idiots. Okay.
Seriously? You took a class on lyrics?
No, I didn't take a class.
Okay. Yeah, I'm gullible.
I'm sorry, but
I guess that would have been high on the list in the engineering program.
Do we have any comments?
We do have a few comments, but they weren't really questions or anything. They were talking a little bit about Les Mis. I can't remember what they are now.
Well, we love comments. Thank you for sending us comments.
Yes. Okay. Well, we're going to be talking about Spielberg today.
And I've got to do better with that, because I really do appreciate the comments. But my work schedule has been insane the past few weeks, so, you know, I don't always get around to what I should do. I got to do my taxes still. And I have pumpkin chocolate chip muffins in the oven, which I have to bug out here in a moment to get. So when you hear that tone in the background, I'm going to have to jump away.
Okay. Well, this week we're going to be departing from our kind of vaguely sort of Lenten theme to talk about Spielberg and his many years as a filmmaker. He's one of the most influential directors pretty much in history. He's for the past, I don't know, 40, 50 years, he's just really defined the American cinema marketing techniques and that sort of thing. We'll get to that in a minute. I wanted to start out by kind of talking a little bit about his background, which is really important to this particular director. Sometimes you have a guy, and it doesn't matter where he's from or who he is, but with Spielberg, it really is very important. He was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, to an Orthodox Jewish family. His mother was a restaurateur and concert pianist, and his father was an electrical engineer involved in the development of computers. They divorced when he was about 14 or 15, and that really had a huge effect on Spielberg's life and the way he expressed himself in his films. And throughout his early teens, he made 8mm adventure films with his friends, and he charged admission about 25 cents to his home films, which involved the wrecks he staged with his Lionel train set while his sister sold popcorn. He later said, "My dad's still camera was broken, so I asked the scoutmaster if I could tell a story with my dad's movie camera. He said yes, and I got an idea to do a western. I made it and got my merit badge, and that was how it all started." So he
wouldn't you like to see that?
Yeah, no kidding. Though you can find some of the earlier stuff. When he was 16, I think that was the year he made his first feature film, which was an indie film, and he put that out there and kind of got in with some people. Ended up in film school. He directed some television, including the pilot episode of a TV show called Columbo.
Huh.
Believe it or not. Which apparently was a very good episode of Columbo. He was then called upon to do about four TV movies, and the first one was Duel, which you have seen, but I have not.
Duel.
What's...
Not Duel.
Duel. How do you say Duel? Is there a Y? It's supposed to be a Y sound right after the D, or, you know. Spanish is so much more simple than English when it comes to spelling things like that.
I don't know.
Decisions. So what's Duel about? Duel, that thing.
It's about road rage, primarily before there was road rage, and the main character is a gentleman who's, you know, going to a business meeting or something, and he kind of cuts off a big tanker truck, and this is all set out west, and the guy gets a little ticked off at him and starts trailing him. And the further they go, the more the stakes rise, and it becomes pretty apparent that the guy that the trucker is insane, and he's but it's just, you know, there's a few scenes in it that are just classic. I mean, and you just think that was just so well done. And I think it's in a lot of his movies. One of the things you have to do is just kind of suspend your disbelief a little bit, and you have to just go along for the ride, literally, in this one, because all the guy's got to do is turn around and go the other direction. It's really, he's only got to turn around and go home. But he won't do that. He keeps fighting forward, and the trucker keeps fighting right behind him. So, you know.
Well, Spielberg, as a director, is somebody who's very good at creating a world in which you can suspend your disbelief. He's someone who is really good at creating just this... He's a very good world builder. He can... you can see that on display in Jurassic Park, even in Indiana Jones, which isn't quite existing in the real world. It's kind of a world where... I mean, you know that people can't take a whip out and, you know, swing across canyons, but in this world, of course they can. That makes sense in that context. And some people can't sell that, but Spielberg is very good at selling that.
Yeah, he's a master storyteller. And he knows how to spin a good yarn.
Yeah, and he can just take something as simple as a truck, you know, and do that.
Usually. when it doesn't work, it kind of doesn't work spectacularly. But, you know, but... Well, maybe I should say instead is that when it works, it works really, really well. When it doesn't work, it's like, meh, you know.
And when he was bad, he was horrid?
Yes. Well, no, when he's good, he's very, very good. When he's bad, he's okay.
Yeah, I mean, he's...
I mean, it's, you know, and I don't know when you look at your list there, but I think some of those...
And almost with Spielberg, he's good and he's bad in the same ways, because it's the same instincts that lead him to different places.
He's also a little bit of an opportunist. He's been able to grab a hold of either technology or ideas when nobody else at least was given the opportunity. For example, E.T. Or especially Jurassic Park. You know, those were movies that, in my mind anyway, that he exploited an idea that everybody at my age, anyway, grew up with. And the technology finally caught up with the storytelling, and he was the first guy, or at least they handed it to him, whichever. But
and really the reason he was able to do that was the initial success of his first big movie, which was Jaws.
Yeah, and he was able to...
Because that made him a household name and one of America's youngest multimillionaires. Yeah. So after that, you know, it was just plain sailing.
Well, yeah, I mean, he hit a few out of the park there early on, and that... positioned him to be the go-to guy, and he's been the go-to guy for ever since. So.
Yeah, and he's kind of looked down on in critical circles. Partly, I think, you know, there's a little bit of sour grapes there. People say, well, he's really a populist filmmaker. He makes things that people like, and he isn't
Frank Capra of our day.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of Capra to it. He really likes to take a story and then blow it up about 10 times bigger than it was originally and slap labels on it and push it out the door. He really likes to appeal to the broadest audience he possibly can and to please the audience. And now that's not necessarily a bad thing, though. I mean, people have... And I was thinking about this because we recently talked about Dickens and how people kind of dislike Dickens because he's just such a upfront novelist. He's not Mr. Subtle, for the most part. I mean, I would argue the other way with Dickens somewhat, and with Spielberg. But he's somebody who appeals to people on very basic levels, you don't need to have some sort of degree to be able to understand him. It's not like T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland or something. It's just something that's very straightforward, and very very understandable. And I think that can sometimes be the mark of somebody who isn't trying very hard, but sometimes it can coincide with a real genius. And I think that Dickens and Spielberg have a lot in common in the way that they convey stories to a wide audience, and the archetypes that they use to convey those things are really universal and really important.
Well, do you think though that, I mean, if he's, you know, he's made movies that are obviously world famous. Do you think he represents America well? In other words, do you think he's... I mean, American movies have so much influence around the world. Right, wrong, or indifferent, I think that's an accurate statement.
That's
right. But the...
I think that...
Do you think he's a force for good in that respect, or not?
Well, he's somebody who couldn't... In a way, you would think he's somebody that really couldn't happen outside of America. He's somebody who just takes so much of American culture and puts it into his movies. Now, he doesn't, when I was thinking about him, how he portrays America in his movies, the only movie that really popped up was Saving Private Ryan, and a lot of people have accused it of being jingoistic, which I don't think it is. But, I think that he is somebody who's very old-fashioned. I mean, he may be a member of the Democratic Party, and he may talk the talk and everything, but in his movies, he's very, very reactionary in the way that he portrays culture. I mean, he's... traditional families are a big deal in Spielberg films. I mean, that is the base rock the basis for all of his stories.
Well, I think that's exactly true, but don't you think... I mean, I think you're exactly right, is that family is very important, but it's always the secular family, right? I mean, it's always kind of a...
Well, I thought we were talking about American...
Well, we are, but I mean, I'm just making a comment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... And I think a lot of his heroes, again, just looking at it from kind of American values, do exemplify... that's not the word I'm looking for. Typify? Anyway. Show a lot of those basic values. Indiana Jones is, you know, the ultimate individualist hero. And Saving Private Ryan is ultimately kind of about saving the principles for that you're fighting for, or saving some... sort of honorable form of warfare, and it's all packaged up and put an American flag on it. It's a pretty patriotic movie, but Spielberg does have more nuance than people give him credit for. I think on that point. Now you mentioned a point on about him being kind of a secular filmmaker, and that's interesting. I don't remember any real instance. Okay, wait a minute. Raiders of the Lost Ark, you have...
Yeah.
Maybe we're being a little unfair to Mr. Spielberg. To jump back to his childhood, he was raised in an Orthodox Jewish household. His grandfather dressed, you know, in the traditional form. He had the beard and, the all of that dress. And Spielberg, when he was a kid, found that very embarrassing. He said, he was teased about it. He was beaten up several times by other boys, you know, anti-Semitic stuff. You know, it was he wouldn't bring his friends around to his house because he was a little afraid they'd see his granddad, and you know, he wasn't sure how to deal with that. And he has obviously come to terms with that now, but there's his Jewishness and his is something that is obviously
what
still
say,
very
what
important.
Say, what do you say he's come to terms with it?
Well, he was telling the story himself. He says, I'm ashamed to say now, I was a little embarrassed about it, and because, you know, when you're a kid, you're very insecure about all that sort of thing. He says, now he has a different relationship with all that. He's made movies like Schindler's List. He donated like $1 million to relief efforts in Israel in, I can't remember what year it was, I think it may have been a war with Lebanon, and that got him blacklisted by some Arab group. And so Jewishness now is something that he isn't trying to distance himself from in any important sense of the word. And of course, you know, now he can afford not to have to distance himself at all.
Oh yeah, I mean he can, yeah, that's right.
He would
have a difficult time becoming blacklisted on anybody's.
Yeah, well, he doesn't have to worry about being blacklisted, really.
Right.
He can take any risks he wants, really. But that kind of brings us to his first big breakthrough hit, which I haven't seen, but you have, which was 1975's Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's Jaws about?
It's about a truck driver. No. It's about, well...
Is his name Stevenson?
It's about a fish. And, you know, it's a big fish. And we were talking this before we started here, and you know, there's not many directors that could take a story about a fish and keep you and terrorize half the country. And I you know, that's tongue in cheek, but it is based on, I think, the Peter Benchley novel, which I have not read and I'm sure is terrific, but you know, an idyllic East Coast summer resort town. Big shark shows up, starts picking a few folks off, and it's just, you know, it's just extremely terrifying for people because it's a real thing. It's a shark. And up to then, I imagine anyway, is that people really hadn't put that much thought into what sharks could do, but they, you know, again, he's so good at taking something that is just mundane and Indiana, you know, an archaeologist. I remember before I went to see that, I was thinking, a movie about an archaeologist, and this is supposed to be interesting. But, you know, he excels, I think, or even like The Duel, you know, or Duel. You know, this battle on the road between a truck driver and a Ford Fairlane or whatever it was.
It's a wonder that he didn't reinvent all truck drivers as evil.
Yeah, I mean, it's
you know,
probably...
That was a TV movie, so it wasn't...
It was a TV movie, but yeah, it's a good point. You know, is that, yeah, I mean, he's a little bit too good at that in some regards.
The Jaws effect was something that was a big deal, because people have talked about, you know, these people going out and hunting sharks and just hunting them down for no reason other than, you know, just a lot of the activism that came out of that. People were just so frightened of sharks, and people didn't visit beaches as much that year, and
oh, yeah.
all that sort of thing.
It was a big deal.
Now, part of it was, part of the success was just kind of the dumb luck thing, because it's a movie that you can see a lot of. It's a suspense movie, more than
it
anything,
is a suspense movie.
Because you never see the shark. At least until later, he reveals it slowly, and the reason for that was because they had lots and lots of mechanical malfunctions with the sharks animatronics, so they couldn't use the shark, so they had to use it underwater, and they had to just build it other ways. And
I mean,
so,
I remember I'm 50 years old, but I remember quite clearly. What year did it come out?
1975.
So I would have been like 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember somebody, and probably one of my schoolmates, you know, we were a very rural area, so we didn't get out to see movies hardly at all, let alone something like this. But somebody talking about the head scene underwater, or, you know, when there's a scene in the movie when they're diving down to this shipwreck, and you know, they had been attacked or whatever, and this body part, it's in the kind of in the dark from what I remember. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but you know, a body part or something or a head kind of floats down through the water, and you know, and it's just, and the guy's in a scuba gear, and you can, you know, and it was funny and terrifying and suspenseful and just brilliantly done, you know, all in one. But I remember that, you know, little things like that from so many years ago.
That really established his reputation for suspense, Jaws, and I'm sure he drew a lot from Hitchcock, who had been kind of the master of suspense before then. Hitchcock actually had a few good words to say about Jaws.
He did it. Oh, really?
He did
pretty well along, I think, in suspense on the Duel. You know.
Yeah, and you can see that those two early movies, really, and he would go on to do more things like that. I think Jurassic Park is probably the most obvious successor to those two.
Yeah.
Both of the first and the second Jurassic Park movies were both directed by Spielberg. The third one was not, and you can really feel the difference because the third one just isn't suspenseful. It's just action-adventure all the way through, and there's no real... It doesn't hide things, they're just there. So, and I'm afraid that's what's going to happen with Jurassic World too, because it looks like an action-adventure movie. It doesn't look like there's any real sense of suspense. Anyway, his next... Well, before we leave Jaws, it was not only influential just on a pop culture level, but it established in Hollywood the business concept of the blockbuster.
Oh yeah.
Before that, there hadn't been... Now, of course, the business model is you bring out something every summer and then kind of bait. It's a tent pole.
When did Star Wars come out? 76? 77?
I think something
77?
Like that, yeah.
So Jaws came out before that.
Yeah, and ever since then, it really has just dominated the box office ever since, that form of of making movies.
Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking, you know, those were very formative years there, a few years in the... With those guys coming onto the scene, Lucas and Mr. Spielberg.
Yeah,
Steve.
They were.
Last time I saw him, I just said, "Hey, Steve."
you know, you two have the same. His middle name is Alan.
Yeah.
Yep, and it's even spelled the same way as yours.
He's a great guy.
And that's the secret to his success.
Stephen Allen.
That's your brother, so you know. It's Stephen Allen. Okay. Well, his next movie was in 1977, and that was Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is another one that I haven't seen. And that one is about aliens.
It was about aliens. And again, it's kind of the... Now, that one, at least for me, I didn't get to see for like years until like years later. But you heard a lot about it. But it was a lot more ethereal. And again... The suspense is heavy in it because these people are kind of touched and they are drawn to a place. Richard Dreyfuss is one of them. And it's just over-the-top, funny, disturbing performance that he has in that thing. But they're being drawn to this site like Devil's Tower, I think, out west, and of course the government set up this, you know, secret landing site for these alien spacecraft, and you don't see him until the very end, you know, and again he holds that back all the way through, but it's so quirky all the way through, and there's so much. You know, so many unusual things happening, and again, he just kind of gives you enough to kind of keep you hooked. You know, as to, you know, what's that about? You know, why did that happen? And you start trying to piece these pieces together, and it's really well done. And you know, it wasn't Star Wars. It didn't have the you know, the space battles and all that, but on its own merit, I mean, I think of it kind of more like Space Odyssey, you know, 2001 Space Odyssey, and it just kind of redefined, and I think it's much better personally than E.T. You know, I just think it's much better because it's a better story somehow. E.T. was more
well, they're different in scale.
E.T. Well, E.T. was more sensationalist, you know, or he was trying to, again, he, in my opinion, that was the first movie he was kind of trying to exploit this big idea. Because I remember when E.T. came out, I'm jumping ahead maybe, but it was the big secret is what does it look like? You know, what's it going to look like? And, I mean, it was a big deal. And they had all the secrecy around keeping, you know, the creature's appearance.
That must have been pretty anticlimactic.
Very secret. Yeah. And so, you know, he was, I think he overplayed his hand a little bit too much there.
Yeah,
he made $1 billion off of it, but still.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind was really kind of his first, I guess, foray into the bigger spectacle. You know,
yes,
it was much bigger than Jaws or any of those other movies. Mostly because he had the money to do that now, and Spielberg loves to have a lot of money to do things. Some directors, when they get money, they lose any sense of restraint, and they want to do everything.
I think he used a lot of restraint now.
But Spielberg has kind of always had that ability to police himself. He's an immensely popular filmmaker. He's very influential. He's still, I mean, after all these years, he's still very influential, but he's able to control that. It's not just going to be something that gets completely out of control. He can still make a good movie. He can still be a restrained filmmaker. He hasn't let it get to his head, which is something I really respect. So, yeah, he really, I think he's one of the directors who hasn't let money corrupt him, unlike Branagh and Peter Jackson, and maybe even George Lucas a little bit. maybe more than a little bit.
I think it's true.
And he's still somebody who recognizes his roots, who doesn't like filmmaking that relies on CGI. He's kind of George Lucas's arch nemesis when it comes to that. Lucas says he wants to use green screens as much as possible, and Spielberg's like, no, let's just not.
I think he understands the importance of what he's doing, at least a little bit. I don't think he's in it so much for the money or the accolades. I mean, he's just got that in, you know, tons of that. But I think he understands, I mean, like Saving Private Ryan, and even to some respects, like Jurassic Park and stuff. I mean, like Jurassic Park, you know, what he did is he dropped a dinosaur movie on a generation of people like me that had grown up with dinosaurs, you know, and knew all about their dinosaurs. They knew all the Triceratops and the Brontosaurus and Tyrannosaurus Rex. They knew all their different dinosaurs. Now, all they had ever seen on the screen were cartoons or stop action for those things, and they were really bad, right? And he drops Jurassic Park so that you've got a, you know, 15-ton dinosaur moving at 30 miles an hour chasing the car. It was fantastic. But I'm getting back to my point there, is that I think he knew that he had to deliver. You know, he wanted to deliver.
Well, because he really did some really hard work on that movie, and he didn't want to do that movie. Jurassic Park came out the same year as Schindler's List. He made Jurassic Park as part of a deal with the studio. They said they were not sure about Schindler's List. This is not a movie they really wanted to back. I mean, it was something completely, it was really different from a lot of the other things he'd done, and they didn't want to put a lot of money behind it. And he said, well, look, I'll direct Jurassic Park if you'll let me do Schindler's List.
Really?
So he did Jurassic Park, and he hurried up and finished it and let George Lucas finish the editing, did the post-production stuff. And meanwhile, George Lucas was in there thinking, Jar Jar Binks, I could do the same thing. And I'm not kidding, actually. That was where he got the idea. He thought, I could do Star Wars prequels, and they would be great. I could use all sorts of stuff, you know. And unfortunately,
thanks, Stephen.
Yeah, that's your one big failure.
Thanks,
Mr. Spielberg. And he went off and did Schindler's List the same year. That was 1993. He doesn't really seem to be like a guy who does a phone-in performance. Sometimes he gets bad movies, and that, for instance, the next movie he did after Close Encounters of the Third Kind in 1979 was a movie called 1941, which was critically panned, and nobody really talks about it anymore, and so we're not going to talk about it either. And then he turned around and came right back with Raiders of the Lost Ark in 1981, which was a return to his, again, to his roots. And that's something really important with Spielberg, because you look back at the things that he was interested in when he was young, and that is where he draws all sorts of these things. He loved the pulp fiction. He loved the comic books. He loved the heroes of the old serials, Zorro and, you know, all of that stuff. And he drew from that to create a hero with a hat and a whip and a gun, and that was Indiana Jones, but just like Zorro. And he did it, he's really better than anybody else has, of creating that, just kind of the king of the swashbuckler genre. And we've talked about Raiders of the Lost Ark already. Then he, right after that, he made E.T. the Extraterrestrial. And something that...
Which is wildly popular. All of these...
I don't remember too much about it. I remember watching it when I was a kid. I think I found it a little disturbing.
Then, you know, I mean, it was fairly... You know, it entered the culture or whatever you want to say. But again, it had a huge anticipation behind it. And if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong, but that may be one of the first movies that really had product placement. It had, like, Skittles or something like that in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big deal. You know. No, it was Reese's Pieces. Reese's Pieces was in it. And
apparently the product placement was successful.
It was.
If you still remember.
It was. Oh, yeah, it was a big deal. You know, because, and I'm sure... It seems like that maybe also made a movie where some of the kids are holding cans of, you know, Pepsi or whatever it is, and making sure that the label was turned toward the camera, that kind of thing. You know,
one of the first things that E.T. did, and I think it may have been Spielberg's first instance of this, was having a child protagonist. Spielberg is rather infamous for his children in movies. There's always going to be there's the Spielberg child. Which is some kid who's kind of adventurous and precocious and, you know...
Like you.
Maybe when I was... I used to...
Like when you climb trees and...
Yeah, I did like that 100-foot...
Before you had a computer.
Yeah, now my computer is my baby. I've named it. Its name is Duffy. Anyway,
so this broadcast is coming to you through the electronic brain of Duffy.
Yeah, because we are too cheap to get a real microphone. Okay, well, Spielberg is somebody that you really have to understand as just kind of...
Once we get 100 likes on iTunes, I will buy you a microphone.
On iTunes? You don't get likes on iTunes.
Yeah, you do. You get ratings, don't you?
Yeah, oh, you get 100. So 100 ratings on iTunes.
100 ratings on iTunes.
You heard that, people. Make it happen.
In fact, if you want to start dealing with me like Abraham did with God, then you probably will be down to... We get 50 likes on iTunes.
but please, Father, if you will allow me, what if we only got 45 likes on iTunes?
If you get 45 likes on iTunes, I shall buy. What if we get 25? If you get 25 likes on iTunes,
we'll talk. It'll be a cheap microphone. let's look on
eBay.
Yeah. Well, okay.
I'll bet Steven Spielberg doesn't have to talk on a laptop.
He probably doesn't. Though he made those 8mm adventure films,
you know,
this film,
somewhere.
So You know, and I think that's really important, because he's somebody who really still likes the nitty gritty stuff in movies instead of trying to do it all digital, which is nice. And children. So,
oh yeah.
What are the defining characteristics of Spielberg's kids?
Precocious. The word
well,
used.
Well, precocious. Yeah.
They're precocious children. They're kind of potty mouth little
brats
that in reality you wouldn't want to have in your kitchen alone, you know, but for them to be in the kitchen alone, but you know, they're generally unlikable.
Really? You got Elliot, you got...
I don't like Elliot.
Okay, well, you got Short Round.
I don't like Short... Well, yeah, you like Short Round, but you're like, why is he here? This is...
Yeah, I mean, I didn't say that there was a good reason for him to be there. I'm just saying that he's a positive character.
Yeah.
Children, Spielberg, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. He's had his hit and misses with regards to children. Elliot, I don't remember too much about. I think he really embodied Spielberg's lasting sense of wonder. You know, the sense of wonder of being able to make friends with an alien species, you know. And Spielberg is very good with wonder. That is one of his trademark qualities. He's well known for a particular shot in which he kind of puts the camera close to the ground so that you're looking from a child's perspective. And he does that even in his adult movies, like Munich. And he does that to create a sense of wonder, you know. And it's been much maligned, and sometimes rightly so. But he's very good with that. And he's very much accompanied by kind of the transcendent quality of most of John Williams's scores. Williams, of course, he scored all of Spielberg's movies after with Jaws. I think starting with Jaws.
Yeah, I think so. Probably.
Yeah, because he won an Academy Award for the music,
which he should have.
And he has only not scored three of Spielberg's films after Jaws, one of which is upcoming. So they've really had a wonderful working relationship too there. And Williams he works so well with Spielberg because they both have that sense of wonder, I think. Just whenever the moment in Jurassic Park when you first see the dinosaurs and the music just surges, I mean, it gets me every time, because the way that he can connect an image to the music and then just make it so emotive, it's just really great.
Yeah.
And of course, Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, all the emotions just come flooding back whenever you hear the first few notes of the score, and it's just adventurous and all of those things. And Empire of the Sun as well, which we're about to talk about.
We ought to do a podcast on music.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Music.
Yeah, and we'll definitely be talking about John Williams, who...
And Mr. Morricone, who gives us our bumper music.
Yes, yes, he does.
The best bumper music in the business.
In the galaxy.
That
yes.
We have right here on
the
Pilgrims
podcast. You have our endorsement, Mr. Morricone. Maybe one day you will go far.
Yeah, if you'd like to come on and be interviewed, well, you know, that's an open invitation.
Yep, you're welcome to do that. Also, Yo-Yo Ma, who performs our opening music, we actually hired him to do that.
Yeah,
we called him up and said, "Hey, Yo-Yo."
Yo-Yo. Yo-Yo.
Yo, Yo-Yo. That poor guy. He must have gotten so many jokes about his name already, but we're just making it worse.
What will we name him? What do you think of Yo-Yo?
Ma. I mean, he's already got a great last name.
I would assume his last name is Ma, is it not?
Yeah, I would assume. So, Mr. Ma.
Maybe it's a family name. Like, you know, Slinky.
Or Pa. The Ma and Pa family.
Yo-Yo, Slinky, you want Slinky? Rubik. This is our son, Rubik. He was named after a yo-yo, a small children's toy.
The
dog. You were named after the dog.
Okay.
Well, I think probably his... So what would you say his worst kid is in all of his movies? The worst kid.
Ooh.
I mean, we probably ought to talk to George Lucas for that one.
Well, let's talk about the best.
Okay.
And you know where I'm going.
Yeah, I do know where you're going.
Because there's only one guy. 1987. Hey, 1987, that's the year I graduated college, kind of, almost, sort of.
You did graduate college, right?
I wondered when that came out. Well, I remember Empire of the Sun, watching it on my mom and dad. My mom and dad got a satellite dish, and so we were watching these you could lock onto a satellite and watch movies for free. And one of them was A Christmas Story, but the other one was Empire of the Sun. And so I think that's the first time I saw it was on there.
What did you think of it the first time you saw it?
I can't remember the first time I saw it. I've watched it dozens of times, I guess, but because it is my favorite movie.
Hmm.
And it probably... I don't remember exactly what I thought. I mean, I was very immature then. I had a lot of, issues. But I don't know. It's a terrific movie. It's just terrific. I love it. I think it's a great movie. We could talk about it the rest of the evening.
Well, I want to do a podcast on it sometime, so we'll kind of keep it.
But that's Christian... I'm sorry. That's Christian Bale is playing the Jim in the movie.
Yeah, that came... quite soon after E.T. I mean, you had Raiders of the Lost Ark, then E.T., then Twilight Zone the movie, which is probably best forgotten, and then Temple of Doom, and The Color Purple, which was his first dramatic movie. He'd been doing kind of the Pulp Fiction stuff of Raiders and Temple of Doom, and even Close Encounters, but now he was trying to do something more serious, and that was a drama set in the American South. Which I haven't seen, and I don't know if you've seen, but since I'm not really familiar with it at all, we're just going to go ahead and talk about Empire of the Sun, which is probably basically both of our favorite Spielberg movie. It's not perfect. It's got its issues, but I'm very affectionate towards it, partly because nobody else has ever seen it, and I kind of like to be a hipster like that, and I know you do, so...
I am a hipster. That's what a lot of people say about me.
Yeah,
you're a hipster.
That's the matriarch over there.
I could get that on my tags on my truck, my Chevrolet pickup truck with the dents in the side.
It would be like
hipster.
HIPSTR.
I was selected in my class to be most likely to be a hipster.
So. You were most likely to be a hipster before anybody else thought it was cool. Okay, well...
I'm keeping up with those crazy kids.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm a Swifty, too. So.
You're a Swifty hipster. And there aren't many Swifties out there, so you've really cornered the market there.
That's right.
Okay.
I'm kind of anti-hipster.
Yeah, well... In Empire of the Sun, Spielberg finally had a good child protagonist. I don't remember much about Elliot. But you had Elliot, and then you had Short Round in Temple of Doom, which was Spielberg trying to introduce the kind of cute ethnic sidekick, and it just really didn't work. But both of those things were starting out a theme which you would find all throughout his career, which is of... children and father figures. And Empire of the Sun actually has three different father figures for the main character, Jim, who ends up lost in China during World War II. World War II is another Spielberg thing. But the real central theme in this one is loss of innocence. Jim has to... It's a coming-of-age story, and when he is separated from his parents, he has to learn how to survive, and he's mentored by Basie, who's kind of this washed-up Indiana Jones figure gone bad. There's a picture in the...
By John Malkovich.
Yes, played by John Malkovich in a rather memorable, quirky performance. he's just doing the Malkovich thing. And at the beginning of the movie, Jim is reading a comic book, and on the front of it is a character who looks a lot like Basie. And my pet theory here is that Basie, you know, is kind of like a corruption of the Indiana Jones type hero. He's somebody who Jim perceives to be very cool, very collected, very, you know, the American hero. And Spielberg kind of takes this self-reliant hero and then just subverts it and says, okay, this guy really isn't a very good person. This is somebody who's in it for himself. And Jim ultimately... all of his father figures fail him, and he has to learn to stand on his own two feet. Can you think of any other examples of loss of innocence in Spielberg's films? I mean, that's kind of going against his instincts, because normally it's the other way around, and we're going to talk about that later.
No, not really. I mean, I will say that you asked me about on what I thought of Empire of the Sun the first time I saw it. I do remember kind of thinking that Jamie, Jim, played by Christian Bale, that was just an amazing performance for his age and for what he was asked to do in that. And I still think that. I mean, he was pretty fantastic in that movie. Young Christian Bale, which I think was his first role, right?
First major role. I think he might have been in a few other things, yeah. And it kind of turned him off from movies for a while, but he was pulled back in by a young director named Kenneth Branagh, who said, be in my movie. I'm going to carry you dead across a field for a 6-minute take and sing.
Because he was young.
Yeah, he was very young in that too. That was 2 years later, I think, in Henry V. That's a good movie too. I would say that Loss of Innocence it does repeat itself in one other film which you haven't seen, but it's called Catch Me If You Can. And that's an adaptation of a true story about a con man named Frank Abagnale, who, in the context of Spielberg's story, runs away from home when he finds out that his parents are splitting up because his mother had an affair, I believe. And he decides to become a con man. He pretends to be an airplane pilot, he pretends to be a doctor, he does all these different things, but he's always trying to get his family back together. That's the purpose of all of this. He wants to restore that, but he can't. In the end, he can't do that. He can't go back, and he can't really be saved. And like Jim, there's a moment near the end of the film where Jim is saying, I can bring everybody back, I can bring everybody back, I can bring everybody back. And he just can't. And it's a really tragic moment when he has to accept that and move on. And for Frank in Catch Me If You Can, which is a fun movie, it's a fun kind of heist caper film, in the end, Frank has to come to terms with that. But Spielberg does offer him some hope. He says, okay, well, this guy's been fleeing from reality all his life, trying to get back to his childhood. But the life of responsibility, there can be some hope there, and that is represented by another father figure who turns up and kind of mentors Frank, and that gives us a segue into our next point, which is father figures, of which there are many in Spielberg's filmography, from everywhere to his earlier movies. You had Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Roy McNeary, something like that. In E.T., the father figure is particularly missing. In Temple of Doom, Indiana Jones has to be a father figure to Short Round. I would kind of argue, and I know this, I would, if I was going to put a really forced metaphor on the Indiana Jones trilogy, then I would say that, you know, that in the last movie, Indy has to be the son, and in the second one, he has to be the father. And I'm still working on the Holy Ghost, but. but it could work. And of course, you know, in Last Crusade you've got a focus on Indy and his father's relationship, and Empire of the Sun you have lots of different father figures. Jurassic Park, Saving Private Ryan, Catch Me If You Can, I think War Horse, I can't remember. Many, many of these movies have a focus on the relationship between a younger man and some, or just a kid or some person who needs an authority figure in their life. And that authority figure can vary. You have in Empire of the Sun, you have Basie, who's not good news. You have in Catch Me If You Can, Mr. Abagnale, who is kind of absentee. He's kind of wishy-washy, and you know, Frank is always trying to please him, but it's just not working. And those are kind of two of the examples of father figures who are not particularly very good.
No, but I'll say this is that in Empire of the Sun, Basie, while he is kind of a loathsome, and he's a survivalist, he gives Jim enough information to survive. And he, you know, Jim says, yeah, you taught me, what was it about the potato?
And people will do anything for a potato.
Anything for a potato. And that's something that's valuable to know in wartime when you're in a concentration camp,
yeah.
You know? And, but you're right. I mean, he's kind of a creep, but he's our creep, you know? And
he's like you, Dad.
Yes.
You're my creep.
I'm a creepy creep. I'm a hipster creep.
You're a hipster creep.
And so, I that's one of the things I really, really like about that movie is just the survivalist instinct of it. And, you know, a lot of people don't understand. I mean, I love that movie because of the realism in it. And I know it could be much harder, and I'm sure it was much harder, but that idea of, you know, she's dead, she's not going to eat that potato, you know, she doesn't need her little bucket anymore. Someone else does, you know, and I do.
Yeah, it strips away, the first part of the movie is set up in a British world that's full of conventions and manners and all of these things that kind of protect you from the wildness,
harshness.
Darkness, the harshness, yeah. And then those things are just taken away, you know, with a slap, you know.
Yeah.
Nobody is stopping that maid from slapping me.
Yeah,
and
instantly.
And Jim has to learn to deal with that. But in the end, Spielberg, I think, has an idea of his idea of what manhood is for Jim to become a man is to say, you know, I recognize that people will do anything for a potato, but I'm not going to do anything for a potato. I'm going to do lots of things for a potato, but I'm not going to kill somebody if it means, you know, I'm
going to keep my humanity.
Yes, he's going to keep his humanity. And he's also rejecting Basie's idea of the world, which is a very self-centered, very
cynical,
libertarian, in
yeah.
a way.
Yeah.
You know, just very extremist. Way of doing that. And I think that's another theme in Spielberg is that his heroes, to become a full human being, have to learn to connect with somebody else or have to learn to rely on someone else. A great example of this is Indiana Jones. Spielberg himself, when he was talking about him, and I know we mentioned this in our podcast on Raiders, said that Jones is not like Bond. He's not somebody who can get shot five times and then bounce right back up and go on for another movie. He's somebody who has scars. He's somebody who has human connections. He really cares about Marion. She's not just some Bond girl. You know, he really makes connections with living people. And in the end, and he's always losing. He's always getting beat up. And in the end, he has to be rescued by God. Sorry, that's a spoiler alert, I suppose. But in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Or that one person in America that's listening to this podcast.
That hasn't seen Raiders of the Lost Ark.
We're sorry, but there it is.
Yes. And what is wrong with you? Anyway, go watch that movie. So Indiana Jones is somebody who is ultimately just a very, very dependent person. You know, Bill Whittle talks all the time about how Indiana Jones is the ultimate American hero. He's got the self-determination, you know, all these sort of things. You know, he's brave, he's courageous. But ultimately, I think what I like about Indy is that despite those things, despite the fact that he knows how to make a living, you know, when he needs a potato, he knows how to get a potato, he's not, he's, there is a humility about him. He's not a strict survivalist. I think the same character arc can be attributed to Oscar Schindler, who, to become a full human being, has to learn to respect other people, or to learn to see other people as human beings instead of just groups of people that either help or hinder his plans, his capitalist plans, mm-hmm. to make money. One of the purest examples of doing that is Dr. Grant in Jurassic Park, who hates children and has to learn to like children by the end of the movie. And that kind of, that's another thing that I think that with when you have a child protagonist, sometimes Spielberg will do the loss of innocence thing and the growing towards manhood, coming of age stories. He does that in War Horse as well. I'd forgotten War Horse. But with father figures, he tends to do just the opposite. He tends to do a return to innocence. So this character, to find fulfillment, has to connect to their inner sense of wonder and humility and all of those things. He did this in Hook, which is another extreme example of Spielberg's sentimentality getting ahead of him. You know, the Robin Williams character is Peter Pan. He has to grow, he's grown up and now he has to go back to being a boy and blah, blah, yada, yada, yada. And that's, I think, a commonality for many of these heroes, that they have to get in touch with that childlike side of themselves. I think even in Saving Private Ryan, that Captain Miller, who's the main character in that, it's kind of a disguised form of the same story, but in the end, Miller has to, the plot of this, and this one came out in 98, the plot of Saving Private Ryan is that a bunch of guys who have just lived through D-Day are going to have to go and save a private who's inland somewhere, basically for a PR stunt, because his other, I think, two or three brothers have been killed, and some general on high doesn't want the mother to have to deal with that. And so he's sending out five or six guys to save this one private and bring him home. And, of course, this squad of men are rather resentful of that. But when they do encounter the young man, he's somebody that is kind of a vision of what they've all lost, because they're all very cynical, very hardened, especially Miller. And he looks at this boy who is very idealistic, very patriotic, and who's... But not in a kind of jingoistic or legalistic way. He's somebody who's very sincere about these things, and it really inspires them. They kind of shed some of their cynicism to become more idealistic and to become younger. And I think that theme continues throughout many of his father figures.
So it just occurred to me that Tom Hanks was in Saving Private Ryan, and he was in Saving Mr. Banks. What are the chances?
He likes to save people.
I think we ought to, you know, we need to, you know what the name of this episode is? Saving Steven Spielberg.
Saving Steven Spielberg.
So there you have it.
Oh, that could...
There you have it. Well, I don't know, as I said before, he definitely has a an authority complex, doesn't he? And that it certainly seems like he's kind of always, I don't know, though, you might say that about any kind of movie that has, I mean, you know, Star Wars kind of has an authority complex, too, with the Empire, and if we all just could live together, I mean, it's not like people are not having a good time in the Empire. I mean, what are they doing?
Yep.
I mean, who's afraid of the stormtroopers for crying out loud?
Yeah, it's like this great evil empire, but they've got terrible marksmen.
Yeah. So, but you know, I think it's a fair point. He's kind of has some authority complex.
Well, frequently you have characters who are allied with the government or something. The government is always kind of the bad guy in these films. In E.T. and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, they kind of swoop in and and deal with these
Raiders
things.
And even in Raiders of the Lost Ark, because they...
Yeah, Raiders, you know, if you like your Ark, you can keep your Ark.
Yeah, top men.
Yeah, in Catch Me If You Can, the government is chasing the hero. Now, that one actually is kind of an exception because Tom Hanks plays Carl Hanratty, who's the guy who's chasing Frank, but they end up kind of striking up a kind of sort of friendship, and he kind of is a redeemed authority figure. I think Schindler's, I would say, is kind of the same way. Schindler is an authority figure who starts out bad and who has to redeem himself.
It'd be interesting to know what his Spielberg's politics are. And I know that he's kind of a liberal, probably a liberal Democrat. I'm sure he is. I mean, I know he's given to the Democratic candidates in the past, but it'd be interesting to have to sit down and say, okay, why do you, and we need to invite him onto our show.
You can, yeah, he can.
If you listen to this, Steve, you know, we'll probably be able to put a slot in for you next week.
Yeah, well, you might have to share with Mr. Morricone.
That's right. You can give John a call, and maybe we can whip up a new little theme for our show.
Yeah, I'm sure he can work that in around everything else he's doing.
Yeah, but what was I saying?
Spielberg's politics.
Oh, yeah. Because he doesn't seem to trust authority. If you look at, you know, your what you pointed out about the movies, and we just finished Schindler's List, and you know, obviously that's got authority issues, but it'd be interesting to see why he believes that, and because he seems to be a step away from a conservative, kind of this conservative thought of...
Well, he's somebody who, like all the great populist storytellers, he's somebody who really understands human beings, and I think that's... And he understands what makes people tick, what people love about stories. He's a great storyteller. And I think that, you know, that's why he focuses so much on traditional things, traditional families, the things that humanity as a whole has tended to embrace. He's not a very edgy filmmaker, and I like that about him, you know, because these days to not be edgy is to be edgy.
Let me ask you this. If you were to take one of his movies and drop it, if you'd never heard of him, okay, though, and drop one of his movies, you know, into the culture or into the mainstream, I mean, and we're looking here at a list of 27, And I don't know which one, but do you think it would do well and stand on its own, or does his name just carry so much weight that it's going to get a lot of look regardless?
Well, it depends on who you'd be talking about. I think that broader general audiences are going to react to different films in different ways. I mean... But yeah, I do think that he has retained his populist touch, not because of his name, or just because he likes the same things that people like. He likes big war epics, and he likes dinosaurs, and he likes adventure stories, and he likes Peter Pan, and he likes heist films, and he likes all of those things that I think that people as a whole really respond to. Now, critics have always been torn about Steven Spielberg, and you know, I can understand why, but he is somebody that is, like Chesterton says, you know, a genius who happens to have the same.
He's the Mike Huckabee of filmmakers.
Yes.
He's the Mike Huckabee of filmmakers. He's a populist. Everybody loves Mike Huckabee. I mean, the critics aren't going to like him, but
it's like God's not dead. All the ordinary Christians like it, but then other people are like, "Oh, really? You've got to be kidding."
They should have let Spielberg do that.
That would have been entertaining. There would have been, like, you know, the kid turns up in his college classroom and the teacher...
With a bullwhip.
Yes. And the teacher says, you know, I am going to prove to you that God is dead, he says, and anybody that defies me, I'm going to call the government.
That's right.
And have you arrested. Well, that's actually probably not a very good metaphor, because God's Not Dead really isn't a very good movie. But Spielberg is something that's very popular, but generally it does make a very good product. Now,
and then the kid gets online and starts a rebel group, right? That,
yep.
Like, you know, I don't know, what do? They do something at the campus overnight.
Robots.
They do something at the campus overnight, so when everybody comes into the campus the next day, it's like completely different or something. That's what Spielberg would do, you know. And everybody would say,
or even better,
everybody would say, this is a miracle.
But the audience wouldn't know that the student had been behind it. That they wouldn't know what destroyed the campus, because it's suspense, you know.
Yeah.
There would be something on campus.
Like dinosaurs.
Yes. They would think it was dinosaurs or aliens or something.
Yeah, they'd cook them up in the lab overnight.
Or robots.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. We'll let you in on that one, Steve, next time.
Yep. Well, we're copywriting that idea. Okay. Let's see. Where were we going with this? Okay, we were somewhere around Empire of the Sun. Well,
and Morricone would do the music for that one. Would kick John Williams off it.
It would have lots of whistling.
Yeah, that's right. It'd be like a, you know, Clint Eastwood, God's Not Dead.
Well, in the 90s, Spielberg had already made some forays into drama. But he really made his first big, super serious film, or at least the most significant one was Schindler's List, in 1993, which he made the same year that he made Jurassic Park. And that, I think, is Spielberg's most sustained effort at depicting government evil on a large scale. There are a few of his later movies that I haven't watched. Maybe he deals with it there as well. But evil. What is the most evil thing in that movie? Is it a person? Is it a force? How does he present it? What do you think that?
Just the idea of, you know, and that's what, as I was thinking, is it's just the power of an idea. Is the thing that's the most terrifying. I mean, truly terrifying. You know, this whole idea of, you know, of the Jews being subhuman. That idea is just, and how those kind of things can grow, is just frightening to me. And people think that we can't get there anymore, and it's like with racism. I mean, we call so many things, in my opinion, racism that really isn't. I mean, it's, you know, maybe stupid things, or it may be.
We've really watered down the term.
We've watered it down so that when you see true racism in its ugliness, and you say, "Well, you're a racist," it's almost like it doesn't apply anymore. And I think that's not good, but. Just, I mean, that's what I got out of it, was that the idea of an entire society, an entire culture, and, you know, buying on to the fact that this person in front of me is less than human, and that I can do anything I want to with them, and it makes no difference, and I will not be punished, and I can just do, you know, literally anything I want, is terrifying. And that person is absolutely powerless to defend themselves. Okay? And that I put them there and I keep them there. Just, you know, that's a terrible, terrible idea. That's what I took from it.
Yeah, it was interesting to me because...
And I'm sorry, and what he does is he plays that out. He says, you know, that idea, this is the end of it. This is where it goes.
Yeah, I mean, partly, he doesn't really... one of the things I found kind of interesting about the movie is that it just presents the Holocaust. It doesn't really explain the ideas that were motivating anybody or the build up to the Holocaust or any of those things, you kind of have to fill those details in for yourself. Now, I mean, he knew the audience was going to do that because everybody knows the story, but it's something that you kind of wonder, where did this come from? What are the motivations here? And the best he kind of gives you is a pot-bellied psychopath that shoots people on a whim. And I think that, but the most, kind of the central idea of that movie was abuse of power. There's a conversation between Schindler and Gert, who is this crazy Nazi, who, and Schindler appeals to his vanity, and he says, real power is when you have every justification to kill, but you don't. And he's still trying to gain power. And both of them really, it's kind of a, you're looking, they both have power, but you're looking at how they deal with it. And again, you're talking about kind of Spielberg's authority complex. He's really always power is something that he's just very, very wary of, you know. And again, that's interesting because, again, you tend to think of that as a conservative thing. Or conservatives do. Liberals don't, because liberals think that conservatives are the old fuddy-duddy establishment. So, you know, I think they look at it the opposite way and think that we're the ones with the establishment. So, you know, stereotypes either way. Anyway, I guess we better go ahead and try and wrap this thing up because we're over time.
Well, it's a big subject.
Yeah, it's been fun to talk about. I guess I probably ought to briefly run through his last few films, but after his shift into kind of serious filmmaking in the 90s, he went ahead and made Saving Private Ryan and a few movies in the early 2000s, and then he kind of made a bunch of sort of so-so movies that nobody was really interested in. Lincoln got really good reviews. That was 2012, so we might be seeing a little bit of a Spielberg renaissance.
But it's like you know, I mean, he has a really big hit. Looks like maybe one out of five.
Oh yeah, I mean it's. He's got some duds, but he's made just so many movies. When it is a good movie, then it's just pretty much a classic, you know. And he's got three movies coming up right now. He's got a movie called Bridge of Spies, which is written by the Coen brothers, which I just think is a match made in heaven. And the BFG by Roald Dahl, and he just announced, I think yesterday or a few days ago, that he's going to be making a movie called Ready Player One.
And he seems like a nice guy. Yeah. Overall, you know, he's not a prima donna. I mean, he doesn't seem to be a prima donna.
Yeah, as Hollywood people go.
Right, and I think he's just a generally likable fella, and that probably a lot of actors like to work with him, and, you know, I'm sure the studios like to work with him because he makes them a ton of money.
Yeah, and he's not anywhere near as polarizing as somebody like Malick.
Right. Ooh, that would be cool if they got together and did one.
That would...
It'd be Indiana Jones standing there looking at something like, should I shoot him? What if I shoot him?
What is the meaning of life?
Yeah. He has a sword.
Flowers.
He has a
explosions.
Sword. I have a gun. He has a sword. I have a gun. He has a sword. I have a gun.
Jean-Paul Sartre says. Yeah. And he would be whispering this, and then it would suddenly cut away, and you wouldn't know what would happen for a whole 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess we better wrap this up. What are we doing next week? I have the answer, so I'm going to go ahead and tell you. We're watching a movie called Ordit, which is one of my favorite movies, but the Patriarch has not seen it. So that will be exciting. It's an old Danish film from 1955 by Carl Theodor Dreyer.
So it's full of old Danish?
It is full of old Danish.
Day old Danish?
Stale Danish. Very stale Danish. Something is rotten
in
the state
of. You're going to get in trouble. You're going to get in trouble. Get our the lawyers. We're going to have to...
All our Danish friends.
We're going to have to run this through our council before we let this episode get out.
Yeah, we'll have to talk to the professor about it. I'm sure he'll know what to do.
Yeah.
I seem to see the same.
Anyway, I think it's on YouTube.
I think our council's on the back of our telephone book. They got an ad on the back of the telephone book.
Is it just me, or are all lawyer ads really lame? I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a good lawyer ad. And they're supposed to be really smart guys, but they're just... Anyway, well, I want to end on with a quote from a fellow from J.G. Ballard, who wrote Empire of the Sun, the book that Spielberg's movie was based on. And he was talking about, a lot of people perceive Spielberg to be an extremely sentimental director, and he had this to say. The qualities that the cineasts see as weaknesses, I see as Spielberg's strengths, and as the reason why he is one of today's most important filmmakers. The producer-director who single-handedly saved the Hollywood film when it threatened to founder in the 70s. Besides, sentimentality and spectacle have a valuable place in the arts, as in the operas of Puccini, though there are Puritans who feel slightly queasy at the thought of Tosca and Madame Butterfly. In many ways, Spielberg is the Puccini of cinema, one of the highest compliments I can pay. He may be a little too sweet for some tastes, but what melodies, what orchestrations, what cathedrals of emotion. To love another person is to see the face of God.